Well, we're going through a series called The Songs We Sing. And this is a series we've kind of put together to illustrate our lives of worship. Not the songs we sing necessarily. We start with the songs we sing, and we usually end up having it be about an every prayer, every breath, every moment of our lives kind of worship. And that's where we want to end up today. And we're going to get there, but we're going to kind of take some really weird paths to get there, and it might be messy and possibly even vulgar and offensive to you, but that's okay because I like that. And so we'll see where we end up, but we're going to get there, okay? So today, my hope is that you will be inspired to look stupid. Yeah, cool. So we got one that's already got it, but if you follow God, you will look stupid. And so I want to start with 1 Corinthians 4 and start in verse 9. And it's going to be up on the screen. But this is something that really hit me through this passage, that we're made to virtually look stupid. Instead, I sometimes think God has put us apostles on display, like prisoners of war at the end of a victor's parade, condemned to die. We have become a spectacle to the entire world, to people and angels alike. Our dedication to Christ makes us look like fools, but you claim to be so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are so powerful. You are honored, but we are ridiculed. Even now we go hungry and thirsty, and we don't have enough clothes to keep warm. We are often beaten and have no home. We work wearily with our own hands to earn our living. We bless those who curse us. We are patient with those who abuse us. We appeal gently when evil things are said about us, yet we are treated like the world's garbage, like everybody's trash, right up until the present moment. And I love what that's saying, and I want to read from the Message. It's still ringing, just do a little bit up here. But in the Message version, it amplifies it even more. It says, "It seems to me that God has put us who bear his message on stage in a theater in which no one wants to buy a ticket. We're something everyone stands around and stares at. We're like an accident in the street. We're the Messiah's misfits. You might be sure of yourselves, but we live in the midst of frailties and uncertainties. You might be well thought of by others, but we're mostly kicked around. Much of the time, we don't have enough to eat. We wear patched and threadbare clothes. We get doors slammed in our faces. We pick odd jobs anywhere we can to eke out a living. When they call us names, we say, 'God bless you.' When they spread rumors about us, we put in a good word for them. And we're treated like garbage." So that's some really fun stuff, right? Really happy. Cool. So a little bit about me. I live in Southeast Greensboro. Southeast Greensboro? What? Okay, like last last service, it was like 18 of them. Like, yeah, yeah. We had a big party and we stopped the service and everything. And then you guys didn't do that. So, cool. I live with my wife, Heather, and my son, Jude, who is almost two, and our two dogs, Mississippi and Mr. Durbin. Mississippi, we got down in Gulfport, Mississippi. Durbin, we got at Hagenstone Park. He just kind of walked up to us, and we said, "Okay, we'll take you home." And then Jude, we got from Heather, and Heather and I have been married almost 6 years today, coming up on 6 years in November, and we didn't take a 5-year anniversary trip. We had some stuff going on in the fall last year, and so we just weren't able to take a trip. So we're taking a 5-year trip around our 6-year anniversary this year, and hopefully go to Maine. We met at UNCG. UNCG? We met at UNCG in 2002. Should I just take this off? Is it bad? Is it bad out there? Okay. I can't tell, so you guys are going to have to tell me and just be real with me if I got boogers in my nose or if it sounds creepy out there. I just need you to tell me because I can't tell. All right, so we met in 2002 at UNCG. We got married later on, and we want to travel and be disciples wherever we go. And I like to write. I like to play music. I love putting songs together. We grew our first garden with our neighbors this year, which was really cool. And we had some tomatoes that turned out and some okra that turned out and then some other things that animals ate. And then I've recently acquired an addiction to Storm Chasers, the show. Is anybody? Thank you. I didn't even. You're like the only one in both services. You're like, me too. Okay. All right. So anyway, I'm addicted to the show. I don't really care, whatever you think. But we've had some storms in our lives and that kind of thing. And so I'm like, oh, I'm really enthralled by this idea of storms and chasing them down and being on offense with them now. So My son Jude, he is almost two. And I hope this story doesn't offend you, and some of the UNCG folks have probably heard this before, but I want to tell it, it's worth telling. It happened 2 months after he was born, about 8 weeks in, okay? And so we started off with Jude, crazy night, you know, it's an all-night birthing session kind of thing, not for me, but for my wife. And so it was a tiring couple of months that we started there. But then there came the moment where Heather got off maternity leave and she said, all right, I'm going back to work now. And I was like, what? And so she said, yeah, you're going to have to take care of him as a good dad, right? And so I say, okay, yeah, absolutely, I'm going to take care of this guy. I got this guy, right? So she's going back to work a few days a week. And as a good father, I wanted to become the watchman of Jude. And it really is like the watchman of Jude. He has more energy than all of you guys combined. And anybody who's babysat him or anything, he's crazy. But what I love about Jude is he has just this incredible, unquenchable spirit that inspires me to be better and inspires me to be. Anyway, I'll tell you more about that later. But I was overjoyed because what I thought about watching Jude was this. Okay, number one, wrestling days. Okay, yeah, you know where this is going too. Okay, and so we would fly kites and climb mountains and play baseball and go swimming, throw gnarly tennis balls at dogs. And Heather later informed me that you can't wrestle a newborn. So that'll hurt them, apparently. So this disappointed me greatly, and that disrupted my plans. So it just didn't happen the way I would have liked it to happen. And so the first day Heather left to go to work, I had some questions. And it made me a little bit nervous being left with a child. I mean, is anybody like a new dad or a, you know, one single kid dad who just had done that before? Okay, I'm the only guy, great. Thanks, appreciate you standing with me. Okay, the first day Heather left to go to work, I was nervous, and so I had some questions that I wasn't going to ask her because she didn't want to hear them. Can he go swimming yet? And I was kind of being serious, like, you know, can he go swimming? I don't know. Is a PG movie okay for him, or is that, like, sinful or something? I didn't really know. How do I feed him? And that was my third question, which was kind of odd looking back on it. What does he wear? Or should I wear, you know, put clothes on him at all? Because, you know, Heather doesn't really appreciate it when I mismatch my clothes, so if I mismatched his clothes, it'd just be kind of a, you know, why make her mad about it? Just don't put clothes on him, right? How do I change diapers? That was my way down the list question. And should I go ahead and throw a real baseball with him, or should I kind of be safe and play softball with him? You know? Those were some questions that were rolling through my head, and I didn't really know how to answer them or whatever, but you know, I thought I can do this. About the first day, it was great. Second day, it was good, and I was starting to get a little bit cocky. Third day is when it happened. And, you know, when you're driving and you're learning to drive on a four-lane highway, you keep it 10 and 2, right? About that third day you're driving, you get a little bit cocky, and you kind of just get one-handed up there, and then you realize you might get hurt. And that's what happened to me with Jude on the third day. And Jude and I are hanging out on the third day, and we're looking at each other because we figured out that that's the only thing you can do with a newborn. because by this point, I'd figure out that you couldn't wrestle with him. Heather told me that was bad, and then you couldn't go swimming. And so I was like, oh man, this is rough. So we just sat and stared at each other all day. So I don't think I fed him. I don't think I changed his diaper. I just kind of kept him in a car seat all day, and I just looked at him. And so that's what we could do. I was successful at that. I did feed him. Thank you. All the ladies are going to be like, you should feed him. And I'm like, duh, but I mean, you know, didn't do it well, all right? So we're looking at each other, and that's what I can do without hurting him. So I got bored with it on the third day, okay? And so this is the decision that altered history. I decided to pick him up. Okay. I reached my hands around him, and he's this size at this point, and he doesn't even, like, let me do this anymore. So I reach my hands around him, and I pick him up, and I kind of cradle him. And, you know, I'm scared that his head's going to fall off. Because, I mean, you know, like, when you're a kid guy, you're thinking, like, okay, you sit, baby sister's got a doll or whatever, and your goal is to make the head pop off, you know, of these baby dolls. And so I'm just nervous as mess because I'm like, this is kind of serious business, right? So I grabbed him, picked him up, held him close to me, and then that's when I knew it happened. It was the warmth and the wetness that only a newborn child could produce all the way up to the back of their hair. And somebody's about to get it, but they weren't sweating, and it wasn't pee. And so, just for the, you know, people who are a little bit slower. And I thought so. I'll let you marinate on that. So, okay. Yeah, poop-tastrophe number one had begun. Okay, and this is poop-tastrophe number one. And you're going to say, oh, okay, how is this biblical? Great. He's going to work it out somehow. We don't talk about poop-tastrophe number two because it's kind of like Fight Club. You don't talk about poop-tastrophe number two. So I took him, and I have him like this, and I laid him down on his changing table. And parents will get this. Okay, he had poop all over him. Okay, so basically I just transferred all the poop to another location now. And so we looked at each other, and Jude and I both know, he's 8 weeks old, and he knows. He's like, dummy. And so he just, he says, what are you going to do now? And I picked him back up, and I'm like, oh, man. And I look down, and I'm like, oh, that's bad. And so I'm holding him still, and so I decide to do the Hulk Hogan move where I rip off his onesie, okay? So I'm like, all right, sweet, you know, and I rip off his onesie, and it came off, but you know where I put the onesie? I put it on the floor. I just threw it on the floor, and then I looked over, and I'm like, oh, no, and then I got it on the carpet. So the carpet has poop on it. The changing table has poop on it. I didn't get rid of anything on him. And so he's just covered in this stuff. And so I'm sitting there just kind of holding him at this point, and I realize that my cockiness, my confidence as a father has been ruined. At this point, he's looking at me, and I am averting my eyes because I have no confidence at this point. I'm just like, I don't want you to look at me. I don't know what to do with you. And so I just kind of am looking around the room holding him, and he's just staring me right now, and it's like lasers, man. It's just killing me. So I say, all right, it felt like 2 minutes, 3 minutes-ish. And so I know it was only like 45 seconds, but it felt like it. Okay, so I say, what is the best course of action? So I say, newborn baby, shower. Right? Perfect. You knew. And so you take him to the shower, right? And so I start to put him in the shower. And did you know that newborn babies are slippery? I didn't know either. They need to come with like grip pads. Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah. So anyway, I was going to start this message by saying he slipped and hit his head. But I mean, like, he's not really in control. So he's slippery. And so he hits his head just enough to make me scared. And so he's screaming, he's got poop all over him, he's naked, the water's running, and poop's everywhere. And so at this point is when I realized that my journey into fatherhood had begun. And this is when I realized that I was a complete and utter failure, okay? So where is this going biblically? Yeah, it's a good point. We'll get there. So that's my welcome to fatherhood. So does anybody want me to babysit? Okay, cool. So I got him cleaned up and calmed down, and you know, I don't think he has any lasting memories of his father's lack of confidence. I don't think so, but it really shook me up and made me realize some things about myself that I didn't know. I probably should never be confident with a 2-month-old ever again. I should just, like, you know, hand it over to Lewis, the expert over there. So what do I say when Heather comes home? How did everything go? Perfect. It went perfect. So what does this story have to do with God? What does this have to do with the Bible? What does this have to do with our lives? My relationship with Jude, I see it as an extension of what God and his relationship will be like. And so when I relate to Jude, I want him to relate to God. And I want to be able to relate to Jude in a way that he will come in his life and relate that way to God. And so if I'm angry, I don't want him to see God as angry. When he messes up, literally, and it's everywhere, I don't want him to think that God bailed on him, okay? So this discipleship that I'm starting with Jude comes right now, right then, in the poop-tastrophes, those moments, in those tough moments, those details. And so, as awkward as it is, he is my mission field as much in that moment as he is now. And he will be in 15, 20 years. So I must be willing to look stupid in order for my son to be discipled. And I must be willing to tell you guys that story and look really stupid in front of you guys and humble myself and lower my pride in order to look stupid and show you that that is still discipleship. That's still forming a foundation to where he will be discipled upon that. And so there are better examples all over the Bible, and you guys are like, you get to them. I am. Paul, the writer of the New Testament, put tons of Christians to death, ended up being one of the best evangelists and church planters of all time. He had a conversion experience that rivaled none other, and met Christ on the Damascus Road, and it changed everything. It changed how we view the Bible. He wrote most of the New Testament, and so how would it be if Paul hadn't chosen to accept that gift and look stupid in front of all the people who said, man, you're putting all these people to death, and then suddenly the change? He was willing to look stupid. In 2 Samuel 6, 14 through 15, it has an interesting verse. You guys, this is going to be funny, but David danced for the Lord. It says, wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all of his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. And you guys wear ephods? Okay. Do you? Cool. Wikipedia, which is our pretty standard source of quality information, it says this: within the Bible, in the context of where it is worn, the ephod is usually described as being linen, but did not constitute complete clothing of any kind. And as the books of Samuel describe, David's wife, Michal, as taunting him for indecently exposing himself by wearing an ephod. So basically, David seemed foolish to all those around him for dancing kind of naked. So don't get any ideas. All right? And David is the guy who was a murderer, an adulterer. God used him greatly. And to the community around him, they were probably thinking, really, this guy? He's stupid. So this made him look really stupid to say that suddenly God had changed him in this way. In the book of Isaiah, chapter 20, starts in verse 2. you guys are going to really like the fact that I'm using a lot of naked verses. I'm sorry. It just happened, and I don't know how it happened, but it did. All right. The Lord told Isaiah, son of Amoz, take off the burlap you have been wearing and remove your sandals. Isaiah did as he was told and walked around naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, my servant Isaiah has been walking around naked and barefoot for the last 3 years. Isaiah's commitment to God called him to walk naked for 3 years. Can you imagine having that kind of commitment? And maybe that's unrelatable now because you'd be like, I couldn't really last 30 minutes, okay? and somehow that was some kind of biblical commitment to God, was walking around naked, which is odd, so don't do it. But unless he tells you, I guess you can do it, but whatever. And then finally, we're going to camp out in Daniel a little bit, Daniel 3. And this is a story that you probably have all heard, but I wonder if you've related to it in this way. It's a story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they were told by King Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to worship the huge statue that was made of gold that he made that he wanted them to worship. And so, or they're going to be thrown into a fiery furnace and die. And they refused to worship his God, and bow down to this statue. And so we pick up in verse 13. And, it says, then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. When they were brought in, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I've set up? I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I have made when you hear the sound of musical instruments. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego responded, O Nebuchadnezzar. I like how they say oh, like they're dismissing it immediately. We do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up. And this had to look really stupid to everybody around them. This had to. Because all they had to do was say, you know, I'm going to bow down. I'm going to worship this. I'm going to get on with that. In fact, I'm going to serve God for the rest of my life right after I bow down and save my life. And because that's the kind of thing that we would say if we were reading it and we were going through it too, we would probably be like, okay, I could probably be a missionary for the rest of my life. I promise God, I'll never do anything wrong again. Just I'll live through this. And they didn't do that. They weren't willing to sacrifice that. And so they looked dumb to people. And this is how the story ends. After trying to kill the guys, I say the guys because I'm tired of saying their names. And after trying to kill them by putting them in the furnace and making the furnace hotter, they wouldn't burn up. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar looks in the furnace and sees four guys. Four people standing there. And it says in the Bible that one of them looked like a god. And this is Nebuchadnezzar's response to the three stupid-looking men after they came out. Then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So they stepped out of the fire. Then the high officers, officials, governors, and advisors crowded around them and saw that that the fire had not touched them. Not a hair on their heads was singed, and their clothing was not scorched. They didn't even smell a smoke. Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. They defied the king's command." This is Nebuchadnezzar saying this. "They defied the king's command, my command, and were willing to die rather than serve or worship any god except for their own god." And I recognize that my story is smaller, that a poop-tastrophe is nothing compared to a fiery furnace, right? Amen. Okay, thank you. I recognize that. I'm very aware. But it's the same. It's my role as a father and as a discipler of my son to do the difficult and small things now so that when he's older, he'll have a foundation of serving others and loving others in the name of Christ. And my prayer is that Jude knows that I love him, and because of that love, he will know about and have a greater love for Jesus, period. And just like the fiery furnace brought Nebuchadnezzar to bring, quote-unquote, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the funny thing is, poop-tastrophe, number one, was actually to bring glory to God in my life and in his life. And I know that you guys have these small details, too, of your lives that are just like that, that you would not get in front of all these people and share it, because you're like, why would you do that? And but they're to bring glory to God, the creator of the entire universe. And so I have this song that I wrote a few years ago, and Tyler recently helped me kind of put wheels to it, and the band helped us put wheels to it and kind of flesh it out a little bit more. And I really love writing songs. I love putting them together. They're like a puzzle to me, and I love putting lyrics of what God's doing in my life on paper and then writing some music behind it or whatever. But a lot of times what I've lacked in the past is just that polish, that kind of making it so that it's presentable to people and helping people learn it, kind of be a part of the story rather than just kind of an observer. I don't know if that makes any sense. But Tyler's great at that, and he does that. And you'll see that on the album over and over again with all these songs that Tyler's just incredible as a musician and an artist and organizer of people, helping people, building people a platform. And so that's why one of the reasons I like Tyler. But this song is called Again, and it was written in a moment of paralysis and stagnancy in my life, in moments where I was having a tough time serving others, loving others outside of my own bounds, outside of the places that I thought that I was kind of contained. If that makes a lot of sense. And so it was really meant to be written as a prayer to contrast against where I was in my life. And so the band's going to come up here in just a second, but I guess you guys can come on up. But in the chorus I wrote, "Please get me moving again, my feet unattached from the ground, and please get me loving again outside of my bounds." And those thoughts just grabbed me. I want my feet to become unattached from the ground, and I want to love outside of my bounds. And I think about the words in Corinthians again. We're not meant to be the heroes and the celebrities of every situation. We're often meant to be lowly and busted up and beaten sometimes. That's not what you want to hear on a rainy day in August, whatever. But sometimes looking stupid is exactly where God needs us to be in order to glorify him, if that makes any sense, where we're unexplainable to other people. And so that's really tough. Are we willing to look foolish? Are we willing to be misunderstood? So in Corinthians, it says one more time, "We have become a spectacle to the entire world, to people and angels alike. Our dedication to Christ makes us look like fools, but you claim to be so wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are so powerful. You are honored, but we are ridiculed. Even now we go hungry and thirsty, and we don't have enough clothes to keep warm. We are often beaten and have no home. We work wearily with our own hands and earn our living. We bless those who curse us. We are patient with those who abuse us, and we appeal gently when evil things are said about us. Yet we are treated like the world's garbage, like everyone's trash, right up into the present moment. When we ask God to get us moving, to love others in the details, and in the furnaces, in the poop-tastrophes, everything, and do the large and simple things that look outlandish to the rest of the world, we're asking him to do something miraculous, but we're also asking him to do something that I don't know that we know what we're asking. It's something that's very powerful, and we might be stupid for praying that prayer. I think it's a stupid prayer in all honesty, because what it does is it does something that we will never comprehend, how big God can work in our lives through that prayer. So this is much larger than how we look or feel, and often we're going to look stupid and feel stupid in order to glorify our incredible God. And so let's bow our heads.